is the New York State AFERD podcast entitled A through Z Health and PE. We are your co-hosts, Drs. C and C, the true Pan-American connection. I am Clancy Seymour, and my tag team partner is the one and only Dr. Victor Ramsey.
Details highlighting our episodes, guests, contact information, publications, and other useful resources will always be included in the podcast show notes. For more information about New York State AFERD, please visit newyorkstateaferd.org or Facebook and social media handles at New York State AFERD. Let's embrace the journey, and now, on to our show.
Greetings, listeners. I'm Dr. Clancy Seymour with my co-host, Dr. Victor Ramsey. Doc, how are you today?
I am amazing, man. Everything is great, man. I'm happy to be here once again with you and with our amazing guests, the one and only Kevin Richards, someone that has been in the trenches for some time, and I'm very excited about this opportunity.
Indeed, indeed. I agree. How about this summer? We're at August 4th today, 2021, and it's been quite a summer in terms of weather in the East Coast.
Yes, that's true. In fact, I'm enjoying this weather. As you know, this is my type of climate. And yes, indeed. And I love the heat. So I'm okay. I'm great.
Yeah, I think I've cut my grass every week since the beginning of April. So with this rain and precipitation, it's been quite an original summer for sure.
Yes, yes.
All right. Well, welcome to episode 8 of the New York State AFERD A through Z Health and PE podcast. In this episode, we will be discussing an article published in Urban Education and written by the prestigious Kevin Andrews, Michael Hemphill, Victoria Shriver, Karen Lux-Gaudreau, and our very own podcast brother, Dr. Victor Ramsey. Woohoo!
Indeed. All right.
The title of the article is Teaching Physical Education in an Urban Intensive Environment. Okay, so this is where it gets fun. And in addition to our co-author, Dr. Ramsey, we are truly honored and excited to introduce our special guest for today's episode, the one and only Dr. Kevin A. Andrews. Dr. Richards is an assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology and Community Health at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. His research focuses on teachers' work-life experiences and socialization, primarily in physical education, as well as teaching personal and social responsibility through physical activity. Kevin, thank you for joining us today, and please say hi to our listeners and, of course, illustrious members of the New York State AFERD professional community.
Yeah.
It's 11:30.
Yeah, Vic and Clancy, really happy to be here with both of you today. As somebody who grew up on the East Coast, it's fun to hear you talking about the weather and other things that are East Coast related. And then, you know, that was one of the things that was kind of fun about this paper as well. It was an opportunity for me to reconnect with a part of the country that I grew up near and you know, has a special place in my heart. Maybe not so much the Yankees, but the city of New York a little bit more broadly.
Well done indeed. Well played. Yeah, so you are in the Midwest, but interestingly, you are from originally out east in Connecticut area, and you did your teacher prep at Springfield, right?
Yeah, that's right, Springfield College in Massachusetts. I met my wife there, had a really good 4-year experience at Springfield, and then had the opportunity to go out to Purdue University and do a master's, PhD, and did a year postdoc there as well. Then I've kind of moved around a little bit. I was at Northern Illinois for 1 year, Alabama for 3, and now I'm starting my 4th year at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and hopefully I'll be here for a bit longer.
That's awesome.
Hey, Kevin, man, I remember when you went out to Champaign-Urbana, you say in 4 years. I thought that was like 1 year ago.
I know, right? Doesn't
it? Time to fly by. Yes, it is. When I met you, it was prior to you getting there, and this is awesome. And you've been someone that, again, I admire your keenness and someone who's always focused. And while we even at conferences and we're going through these sessions on research, I see how you are so diligently attentive to the results of many studies. And it's something that I admire in seeing what you do with this work. So thank you again for being here.
You're too nice, Vic. You're too nice.
And, you know, speaking of diversity, which we'll chat about certainly today,
right.
We have Kevin from the New England and Boston, Massachusetts area. We have Dr. Victor Ramsey, originally from the South American continent, but now living in New York City. And then we have myself from the Toronto area, originally a Canadian, a proud Canuck always, but now living in Buffalo, Western New York. And with that comes tied or comes again, allegiance to my Toronto Maple Leafs and probably Victor Ramsey, New York City sports teams. And Kevin Richards, we won't hold it against you, but the New England sports industrial complex that seems to dominate all of sports right now. Yes. So that's pretty exciting. Talk about diversity in a nutshell right there. All right. So really excited because not only do we have Dr. Richards, but we have Dr. Ramsey, both co-authors. So I guess in an elevator pitch, if you will, why don't either of you, both of you, take a couple seconds and tell us a little bit.
Set up these environments as a negative place from Jump Street. And I don't know that that's really a good way to go about it. They have their unique kind of characteristics, but there's also a lot of great things and a lot of great opportunities that come from teaching an urban environment. So I think making that more part of our teacher education program, if not you know, getting students experiences in those schools directly, at least having conversations about them. You know, and also thinking more broadly about the differences across different types of urban contexts, and then pedagogical practices that have particular application in more urban type schools. And so teaching personal and social responsibility, or TPSR, is one model that, you know, was developed within urban environments, within the urban intensive environment of Chicago. So, you know, I think that provides a good pedagogy for entering these schools. You know, so that's kind of a broad strokes take on this. To be a little bit more specific, Vic, I think that an article like this would be a really good article for students to read and then have a conversation about, especially if you're trying to get at issues of race or language or cultural diversity that come up so prominently in the article. Sometimes those things are hard for students to have a conversation about, you know, in a typical class setting. But an article like this kind of gives you something to talk about. It gives you a launching point so that you can kind of get to, okay, well, what are the realities of this like? You know, how do we approach issues like race, linguistic, and cultural diversity within our classes? And so I might have students read this and then break off into groups, have small group conversations about different elements of the article, maybe pose questions for them, and then bring it back to the whole class and just have a broader conversation.
Well said. Yes. You know, the one thing that struck me, and I'm going to bounce around because, you know, from Kevin's words so far, it reminds me of a point in the article where it talks historically about hirings in New York City. And I'm reminded, being in the second largest urban district in New York State, being Buffalo, I'm reminded of some of the gaps that I see and have seen over the, you know, the last 20, 25 years in physical education. And one thing that really struck me is how New York City and Buffalo and other urban centers have been allowed to hire PE teachers that are not certified. Yet Kevin starts his conversation with how critical future professionals must be trained when it comes to urban intensive environments.
Yeah, I like to add that the fact that you brought up the various aspects of the urban environment that are realities, i.e. race and other issues, that speaks to that whole culturally relevant pedagogy. And the idea of having a conversation after reading the articles is essential to sort of like globally understand that whole complexity. So I totally agree with that strategy of using the article in this sense for teaching or for instruction to inform your students, Pete and Heat students, certainly.
And you know, I think it also points to, you know, there's a question in there about how do we inform practitioners, or what are future workshops and professional development that we may consider. And I guess where I'm going with this is how critical it is to communicate to school districts, particularly large urban centers, that you need licensed practitioners. And here's why.
Yeah. That I was excited to see that question that you had in here actually about workshops, because it actually ties in really well to what me and some of my doctoral students at Illinois are doing right now. So myself and Karen and others have spent several years, and I don't mean to just limit it to our group. You know, this work goes all the way back to the work of Lawson and Templin and, Lacey and Lordy, if you go outside of physical education, but these, giants upon whose shoulders that we stand. But, over the last several years, Karen and I have been really investigating different types of psychosocial experiences within physical education environments and trying to develop some understanding of how we can use more positive and pro-social experiences to help combat challenges like marginalization and isolation, and then have an impact on, teachers' well-being by increasing resilience, and by decreasing things like stress and burnout and propensity to turnover. So this study is all, I would say, part of that work, trying to understand these different variables and experiences. And what we're doing right now, I have a doctoral student named Shannon Pennington, who actually Kim Graber and I co-advise. So Shannon's dissertation is looking at a professional development intervention that we're calling Project Dream. And that's developing resilience and enhancing appraisals of mattering, Dream. We have an article that just came out in Quest that overviews the kind of conceptual framework that underlies the professional development model. But in short, it includes kind of four components that relate to emotional regulation and display, caring and listening practices, relationship building and advocacy. And the idea is that through a professional, a protracted professional development experience, it's not just like a one-shot off workshop, it's a longer experience than that. Teachers are engaged in conversations about emotions and about interpersonal relationships and about advocacy. This helps elevate their emotional intelligence. Then that should, our hope, extrapolating from what we've done so far in kind of non-intervention research, is to see that reduces reported feelings of stress and burnout and, increases their perceptions of resilience and mattering.
That's an interesting point that you're making there, Kevin, because we're currently conducting a series of screening for newly hired physical educators in order to, seek their understanding or grasp of content, knowledge, and so on and so forth. And I can just see this, as you stated, with this professional learning opportunity for them, because one of the questions we asked them off the cuff is, why do you want to teach in New York City? And then we go into talking about that whole social emotional learning and all the relationship building to what you meant to speaks to what you talked about.
It does. And what I would add to that, Vic, is that if we want teachers to help improve or facilitate the development of emotional learning, social emotional learning in kids, then we need to also make sure that their own social emotional learning.
Absolutely.
If as a teacher, you're not mentally, emotionally, socially prepared to do your job, and you don't have the right supports in place, then how are you going to bring that down to the students? And that's actually the kind of the long-term goal that we have with this line of research, is to be able to connect those dots and show that the teacher experience trickles down to affect the student experience. I think that notion is really used to justify a lot of the socialization research. I use that justification as well. But as of right now, we really don't have much evidence in physical education to show that how teachers feel impacts how students feel and learn.
Well said.
Absolutely. Yes, one of the things that are important to note here is that we want our listeners to be able to have a clear understanding of the distinctions that the authors made among the urban intensive versus the urban emergent and urban characteristic schools. So could you please elaborate on this to get our listeners to have a better sense of the distinctions that you mentioned in that research.
Yeah. So this is another kind of cool moment where I can take you behind the research again for a second. All of this stuff about urban intensive, urban characteristic, urban emergent, none of that was in the original submission of this paper. The editor basically said, you know, the term urban is vague, and it doesn't really capture the diversity that you see across different types of urban environments. People will use urban when they're referring to New York and Chicago and LA, but they'll also use that term in other cities like Columbus, Nashville, Charlotte. In those six cities really are not playing in the same sandbox in a lot of ways. Milner in 2012, and this is kind of what we pulled from when we kind of developed that distinction and further elaborated the different types of urban environments. So Milner noted that in urban intensive schools are located in large cities. So you have populations of over a million in which many residents live in poverty and in densely populated areas. These schools are typically in inner cities where issues outside of school tend to permeate and influence experiences in the school. So issues related to housing, transportation, access to technology, that might be these kind of broader social experiences that happen outside of the school setting, kind of infuse and influence the way that students experience school and the way that teachers experience school as well. So those urban intensive environments, that's what we looked at in this study. New York City is definitely an urban intensive environment. In the US, it might be the poster child for what we consider an urban intensive environment. So by contrast, urban emergent environments are cities like Nashville, Columbus, Charlotte, that experience resource challenges, but maybe not to the same extent as these larger, urban centers, and their populations tend to be a bit lower. So the benchmark that Milner gives is about a million people is that kind of cutoff between urban emergent and urban intensive. I'm sure that that's just kind of a rough estimate, but you get the idea that these urban intensive environments have very, very large populations. And so finally, you have schools with urban characteristics, and these are located outside of large cities but are beginning to experience many of the same challenges. So large concentrations of English language learners, for example, that's something that we tend to see in urban environments. And it actually came in into the result of this study talking about that linguistic diversity. But a school with urban characteristics is starting to experience that as well. So in coming into this study, and this is again something that we had not considered, but after the editor gave us this feedback, it's one of those things like sometimes you get a review and it just hits you square in the face, and it's like, yeah, that's exactly what we should have said the first time and we didn't. And this was one of those things. So, the editor essentially said, we have to use this term urban. Like there's value in talking about schools as being in urban environments. There's value in studying them. There's value in understanding the realities of them. But at the same time, we have to remember that urban is not a neutral term. And it can be become a source of marginalization for students, particularly because it often becomes conflated with race. And so when we think about urban environments, we tend to think about environments that are very concentrated with people of color. And when we conflate those two, that can become a bit dangerous. And so discussions of urban environments, including this one, I just think should have that in mind that, we're using the term urban because we think that it has some classification value and some contextual value, but there's also some challenges that go along with that term.
Interesting, that last part that you're talking about is definitely intentional in when sharing this information with our future professionals, in that you have to have these honest conversations. And what you said about we should have mentioned and we didn't mention it, and you reflected on that and say, you know what, totally. So this is something that needs to be said, and it was said and can be used for future professionals to know and understand.
Yeah, Vic, it makes me think about the difference between like an assets-based and a deficits-based mindset. And I see this a lot with our pre-service teachers when we start, you know, so down in Alabama, we brought them out to a school that was, you know, right outside of Tuscaloosa, very high poverty rate, very high concentration of underrepresented minority students. I went into it and was like, this is going to be a great learning experience because, you know, we're getting a lot of the stuff that we're talking about in this paper that our students were getting. But what we came to see was that a lot of the students kind of started to develop these deficit-based mindsets where it's like, okay, well, we need to go in and fix these poor Black kids. And then you get caught in you know, what we referred to somewhat colloquially as the white savior trap, where it's like we're going in as these white people into schools that have high diversity, high concentrations of people of color, and we're trying to tell them how they should do things and how they should think about things without understanding the cultural norms that underlie the value systems that are in place. And so your comment made me think about that, Vic, because I think by talking with students about this and being intentional about, we're not just bringing you out here, but here's why we're bringing you out here, and here's the goodness you're seeing, here are the assets that we can recognize and build from, rather than trying to correct all these deficits or these problems, that is really the attitude that we need to instill in these teachers as they're coming through our programs. You don't come to New York City because you want to save it. You come to New York City because it has things of value that you want to build upon and make better.
Kevin, you speak to something that we did for 4 years with a prominent Southern university, a collaboration that someone reached out to me, and to protect the privacy, I collaborated with this major university for 4 years in a row. To your point, the students traveled to New York City and spent about 2 weeks visiting many schools that I identified on various tiers, something to what you're talking about the urban intensity sort of like characteristic and so on. And the very last group, there was some sort of a disparity with the understanding or misunderstanding of the cultural norms of certain students. And this was something that was a teachable moment in real time for these students who came from this prominent university. And yes, all of them were white students and came to New York City for the purpose of what you're saying, which was indeed something I trust went back, was taken back as something that they learned about the cultural norms and learning from these experiences and not coming in judging or trying to fix, as you stated. So thank you for that, for pointing that out.
Yes, great stuff, gentlemen. This question and these terms and distinction between these terms particularly resonated with me for the same reasons. And referencing New York State, you know, we have New York City, but we also have Buffalo Public, the second largest urban school district, which might fall under the second classification as urban emergent, similar to Nashville, Columbus, something like that, right? But we also have Yonkers, we have Syracuse, we have Rochester. So I suspect that all of those would be urban emergent, right? But quite a difference, yet many would not view that as being different right away from New York City versus Buffalo. I remember a couple of years ago, Dr. Ramsey got me to come to New York City to do some training workshops. And it was probably one of the highlights of my career thus far to be able to offer PD to New York State PE practitioners in the trenches. If anything, they should be teaching me, right? And I learned a lot about the culture of New York City schools from there. And I started to make comparisons to what I've seen in Buffalo Public Schools, because that's in my backyard. That's what I see. And I saw a lot of similarities, but this article really started to paint a picture about the differences, the small nuances, the differences between urban emergent versus urban intensive, and even urban characteristic. As both of you know, my better half, Karen, is a Buffalo health and physical education teacher, Buffalo Public. And she experiences many of the issues that are discussed in the article. But, you know, urban intensive is a whole different sphere, a whole different ballgame, if you will. The literature suggests that, you know, again, that colloquial term urban, as Kevin pointed out, you know, that the literature suggests that there's a lot of similarities between urban and rural. And maybe there are, but they're different. And it comes down to, yes, probably poverty impoverished, but different types of circumstances.
Different mechanisms.
Share about that?
Yeah, I've seen some of that stuff as well, looking at, you know, urban and rural. And I think what you have are outcomes that, at least at face value, outcomes like poverty, for example, that at least at face value look similar, but have drastically different driving mechanisms.
Exactly. Like
there's a lot of different ways that you can experience poverty. And my guess is that kids in New York City experience poverty quite differently than kids in rural Illinois.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about resources, the article addresses resources. Yes, rural or urban characteristic schools probably have issues with resources and in particular physical education, but they don't have issues with land or perhaps facility. Urban intensive schools like New York City schools, they are landlocked. They're sharing buildings between two schools, three schools, may not even have a gym. I mean,
yeah, they're literally on top of each other.
Yes. So while the literature suggests there's a lot of similarities, there are nuances that future professionals and PE practitioners need to understand. That's critical. Okay, awesome stuff. This segues nicely into our next question, Kevin. You and the authors highlight from the study about marginalization or perceived mattering issues and how they may be exacerbated by urban settings like New York City. Can you tell us more about what you mean by that, or what perhaps some of your participants might be trying to convey?
Yeah. So, you know, the teachers in the study definitely noted that working in New York City presented some unique challenges that some of them felt as if might differ from other contexts. You know, some of them were hesitant to make direct statements comparing contexts because, you know, and I appreciated this. They said I'd never taught anywhere other than New York City, so I don't know what it's like to teach in a suburban area. But here's kind of what I think based on conversations with people who I know. And so this work, I think, does a really nice job of highlighting the intersection. And you brought this up before, Clancy, but that intersection between the subject that one teaches and the context in which they work, which further emphasizes why context so facilities and equipment were a big part of this, particularly in contexts where schools shared a single building and gymnasium. That was a wild thing that we did not expect to find. Another good kind of behind the research moment. You know, we had a question on our interview guide that was basically like, tell me something that's unique about teaching in New York that people in other school types of schools might not understand, something like that. And, you know, of the first like five or six people we interviewed, several of them tell us these stories about how multiple schools share a single building. And I'd never heard anything like this before anywhere, but I guess the history, and Vic, you can correct me if I get any of this wrong, but the history from the participants was that, you know, New York City for a while had these like mega schools where you'd have huge, like 4,000 or 5,000 student school buildings.
Yes.
And then, you know, eventually they figured out, well, having 5,000 kids in one school doesn't make a whole lot of sense. We're not going to do that anymore. But you've still got these massive buildings. So what do you do with them? Well, they break it out so they have multiple schools that occupy a single building. So first floor is one school, second floor is a different school, third floor is an entirely different school. So with each of which their own administrations, their own teachers, their own students, lack of crossover. Well, one of the ways that we did find through this study that they cross over, however, is that even though these schools were designed to house 4,000 or 5,000 students, many of them don't have multiple physical activity spaces. So they might have like one really large gym. Well, then you've got to coordinate across three different schools with three different administrators, three sets of physical education teachers, all trying to use one space. No, thank you.
Yeah,
that sounds like it would be, you know, an absolute disaster. But so we didn't have a question about that on our interview guide originally. After hearing that story several times, we revised the interview guide and asked that question to every single person we interviewed thereafter. The teachers also felt as if, you know, physical education was not viewed as a high priority in a district that was so large and experiencing so many other problems that were perceived to be more important by administrators. So on the list of things that, you know, needed to get done or needed to get revised or needed to get, you know, needed a makeover. Physical education was probably on it, but they didn't feel like it was very high on that list. You know, according to one participant, this is perhaps best reflected in the fact that as of 2014, at least, New York City had not filed a new plan for physical education in the district since 1982. You know, kids have changed, society's changed, physical education's changed a lot between 1982 and 2014. So the fact that they were still operating off of that plan from before I was born doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Nevertheless, you know, with all that said, there was some marginality. They perceived that, they noted it. I don't want to paint a one-sided picture here, because several of the participants were actually really encouraged about what they were seeing in terms of change, including the district offering more relevant professional development opportunities and a $100 million investment in physical education that was being used to hire new teachers to better meet physical education minute requirements across the district, and to have physical education taught by certified physical education teachers. So, you know, then at the individual school level, so those are kind of district level factors, at the individual school level, and consistent with what we see a lot in the literature, social relationships really mattered for teachers in terms of developing mattering and reducing marginalization. You know, in particular, school administrators, principals set the tone here. And kind of helped to pave the way for how physical education was seen. So if the principal valued physical education and thought that it mattered, then other people in the school were more likely to kind of follow that thread. But if they marginalized physical education, then it becomes you know, easier for others to marginalize it too.
Interesting that we're looking at the shift after to the point that that was mentioned about the financial support to hire certified teachers and provide solid and quality professional development opportunities, and that we're noticing and starting to notice a shift in the mindset of that last point that you made about administrators understanding the benefits of physical activity, physical education, and thus helping advocate, help their teachers advocate. So there's some changes and good things that are coming out of this this opportunity that we had to look at New York City and the marginalization of physical education as a whole. So thank you for sharing that as well.
Sure.
I agree. And, you know, again, an important question that I think Kevin has eloquently detailed and answered. You know, I found it really interesting in the article where some of the subjects or participants talked about how anytime physical education experiences a hindrance, the first thing that is asked of them is, okay, why don't we do fitness? You know, so, and that's a perceived matter, and that's a you know, that's a marginalization thing again. You know, talk about deficit versus asset driven physical education and health education instruction, right? And then oftentimes even the teacher-student ratios. So in the article, it talks about how if there's three teachers on hand, they can put 150 students in the gym. And that satisfies the teacher-student ratios. But I'm sorry, if you have three physical educators with 150 kids in the gym, it doesn't matter if the ratios are acceptable. I'm not sure how conducive a learning experience is going to be for physical education students. And it's not this, and this is not just in New York City. We see this around the country, if not the world.
Yep. Yeah. And that's exactly what I was just going to say, Clancy. And I think this is a good example to show how sometimes these issues that we might see in an urban intensive environment are not, you know, specific or unique to an urban intensive environment, and sometimes permeate other environments. You know, when I was in Alabama, you've got, you know, and I'm trying to be conservative, so not to overblow my estimates, 80 to 100 kids in a gym at once with one PE teacher and an instructional aide if you're lucky.
Wow. You know, and you talk about in the article about internalizing marginalization, and that's what happens. And that's kind of why I think this question is critical, because it may be the case that when you have these urban intensive environments, it may exacerbate marginalization in PE just because of those really stressful situations, you know, something to certainly consider. You know, the book by Rossi, Workplace Environments, I think speaks to it. And I have to give props to Dr. Casey, who brought this book to my attention. But I think some of the tones and messages from this article really speak to the fact that sometimes physical educators, and in particularly in urban intensive environments, are on an island, and sometimes on an island between three different schools, as Kevin pointed out.
Yep. Yep. Exactly.
So interesting stuff for sure.
Yes. So thank you very much again, Kev. So diversity is a term oftentimes used and could be somewhat confusing for some folks to understand the term as a whole. We hear equity, diversity, inclusiveness, for example. But in this study, participants questioned diversity in New York City schools. Could you please explain to our audience how this information can be used positively, or was used positively by urban physical educators?
This was the question that I think I gave the most thought to out of all the ones that you guys posed. So I've got some thoughts, Vic, and I'm happy to share them. But I'd also love to hear your perspective, both on what I say and then also just what you think independently of me. To start off with, participants did note that there was diversity within their schools and that the diversity of New York City more generally contributed to feelings that New York City presented a unique teaching environment with experiences distinct from other environments. So it wasn't that they were saying that there was no diversity. They recognized language and cultural diversity. Those were probably among the most commonly talked about forms of diversity. One teacher said that there was like 40 different languages spoken within the school that they taught in. Other teachers talked about students from all over the world and all these different, countries that they came from or that they could trace their lineages to. So diversity was front and center. But at the same time, I think the participants questioned the use of the term diversity as a blanket statement for describing the realities within individual schools. And this is where I think we get back to that notion that context matters. Saying that all schools are diverse hides the racial and ethnic division that many participants noted across schools. Some participants noted that schools could be quite segregated and actually lacked internal diversity. And we saw this a lot in the South when I was down in Alabama. Officially there's no segregation, but the way that they draw school district lines and the way that they determine who goes to what school often perpetuates this systematic racism where you still have white schools and black schools, but just not officially. Right. And so that was kind of what I felt like the participants were saying, that there's some of that going on, that you still have high performing schools with high poverty and high concentrations of underrepresented minority students. And then across the street, you've got the schools that tend to be more white, that are more high achieving and that have more resources and, are a bit better off. So I think this is important. Because assuming that everything is diverse and that there are no problems with school level diversity in a large diverse city perpetuates narratives that support covert systematic racism that underpins school segregation and inequitable distribution of resources. So that I think is what these teachers were getting at. And that's why I think it's important to have that message out.
This is interesting because UCLA conducted a study in which they look at New York City and diversity and racial disparities in New York City, while being one of the most diverse city systems in the country, still remains segregated.
Yes.
And
yes.
That was noted in some schools where, as you know, for example, out of, let's say, 1,000 applicants for a gifted school or a prominent school of that sort, only 8 African-American students were accepted to this school of 1,000. So that's indicative to what these teachers pointed out in this study as well, because there is, while it could be a global sphere. It could be also in a microcosm of their individual schools. So it's the point that you pointed out. Go ahead.
And it allows you to continue this kind of false narrative of meritocracy, where it's like, oh, if you work hard and you do well, it doesn't matter where you come from, you can get anywhere. And you know, there are a lot of barriers to that being a reality. I mean, meritocracy really isn't the thing in this country, and it's been noted to be a false narrative for decades, but it's still something that we use, and it's one way that you kind of hold poorer communities back and hold people of color back by essentially blaming them. Well, right. This is meritocracy. So if you had done well, if you had worked hard, then you'd be able to get into that school, or you'd be able to get into that college. And that ignores the underlying systemic racism that continues to influence the lives of people of color in this country, the same way that, you know, other narratives ignore the continued perpetuation of sexism.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Perpetuate indeed. And I think that's really kind of an underlying message in the article too, that diversity means a lot of things, right? It's not always something we can see. It can be, but it's not always something we can see. And diversity can be obviously sexual orientation, age, gender, ability, high versus low. We have great movers in PE. We have low skilled movers in PE. So diversity means so many things. With a population of greater than a million, it makes sense that New York City schools are among the most diverse in the world, if not obviously the United States, for sure.
Yes.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I think this segues nicely to kind of our, you know, a wrap up closure types of questions here. Why do all PE teachers, whether they're urban or not, need to read this article or need to discuss these issues, and in particular related to kind of policy and educational reform? And when I say PE teachers, obviously I mean future professionals as well. Why do you think?
Yeah. This kind of brought me back a little bit to that, I think, the second question where I talked about the Project Dream program that we're working on, and kind of the line of research that led up to the development of that, and kind of just the way that it made me think about things. In developing these programs that encourage teachers to take responsibility for their own role in developing a positive workplace environment that promotes perceived mattering resilience is important. That's what Project Dream, you know, we hope we'll be able to do. It's seeking to empower teachers to play their part and play their role in creating better schools by focusing primarily, in our case, on relationship development and social and emotional awareness. At the same time, however, when not accompanied by initiatives that develop policies that are more supportive of teachers, this type of work can be seen as the Band-Aid applied to the bullet wound. We all need to push for change in the development of more equitable and hospitable schools, and members of the physical education profession, both faculty members and in-service teachers, should see themselves as agents of change at the local level, but also extend that out to state and federal policy initiatives as well. Really what we need to do, in my opinion, is to affect broader change, because in a lot of ways, schools are not hospitable work environments. They present suboptimal characteristics that make teachers' work more challenging. Even if you think about just the regular kind of flow through a day, many teachers have one 30-minute planning period. So if you're actually like planning your lessons and you're actually doing a good job with it, let's be honest, you're not doing that during school time. You're doing that outside of school. You're giving your personal time up to develop better lessons for your students. And we've crafted this narrative in our society, and we've convinced people that it's true, that as a teacher, you are obligated to go above and beyond and to do outside of work tasks because it's for the kids. It's for the kids. And yes, you know, we want, many people get into education because they care about kids. They want kids to have a good experience. They want to go above and beyond. But it's also created this situation where now we feel okay about dumping more and more and more onto teachers and just telling them to go do it because it's for the kids. Without really attacking, or maybe attacking is not the right word, but without really addressing these underlying policy level issues that create these environments where we have to ask teachers to do this stuff in the first place. So you know, if you think about how do we do that, state associations in Shape America, you know, have provided, I think, these broader opportunities through things like Speak Out Day and other advocacy and lobby day initiatives. I know in Indiana and Illinois, they have a yearly lobby day. You all might have one in New York as well, where you go to Albany and talk about the importance of physical education at the state level. But those types of opportunities are there, and the state and national associations are already doing them. But you know, go beyond that, I don't think that political activism is something that everybody is comfortable with. And I also don't think that it's something that many of our teachers are trained in and taught and talked about a lot within teacher education programs. You know, in my time at Alabama and spending the 3 years that I was down there in that school, working with in a high poverty environment, with primarily children of color, I begin to see my teaching as a political activity. And I don't know that a lot of teachers see it that way. And they don't see that their actions as an instructor communicate a political agenda in many ways. So I think that our teachers need to be better equipped to do that, and better equipped to understand the political process and advocate for what's best for them and their students. And accordingly, the process of encouraging teachers to see themselves as agents of change should be something that we address within physical education programs. I think that some programs do that and do a really good job with it, but not all of them.
Well said, Kevin. You know, and that's exactly kind of the aim of that last question, is understanding not only you mentioned the students, and that is first and foremost, but the profession itself. We owe it to the profession itself. And you know, you mentioned the politics, the political considerations, and you're right, it may not be cut out for everyone, but in order for us to have a seat at the table when it comes to policy reform or you know, educational policy agenda, we need to be well informed. So it may not be for all PE professionals, but it will be for some. And in the past, it has been for none. And that's what we have to think about. You know, and then maybe it's not for some. And so there's a micro political kind of agenda or literacy, as other authors have attuned to, you know, micro political literacy within school contexts that we can be better at when we think about, you know, positioning the profession moving forward.
Yes, and I think
and it's not all doom and gloom. You spoke to this earlier, Kevin, with the PE Works initiative, $1 million in a hiring incentive. Maybe I got the numbers wrong off the top of my head, but was that the number?
Well, 100 million.
$100 million in this PE Works initiative that we're right. Still seeing the ripple effects of that right now with our PE professionals being hired right. Around the country to come to New York City. So these types of studies, kudos to you and Dr. Ramsey and your co-authors, have you know, revealed and made people aware about some of the things that we need to consider when it comes to urban intensive environments, and shed light on potentially how we can make them better. Kudos to you for sure.
Yeah, I really want to express my gratitude to the teachers who participated in this study. I think that it was an incredibly important opportunity for us to share their narratives and to get their voices out into the literature, so that hopefully they can be heard and that their realities can become known. But on a very different level, on a personal level, this was a very important study for me in my development. You know, I am a white cisgender male. Straight male who grew up in, a very white sheltered community in North Central Connecticut. And I don't know, you know, a whole lot about the day-to-day realities of working in an environment like New York City. And I'm not going to say now that I know the ins and outs of it completely, but hearing these teachers and listening to their voices and hearing their stories was educative for me. And I don't want to take that for granted. I appreciate the fact that they use their time, you know, without compensation to share their stories, both to educate me and the broader community.
That's a humble delivery there, Kevin. I'm very grateful for that as well. And when I hear the word advocacy, I think it's a line clearly with politics, internal or otherwise. And you use terms like addressing the issues, and therefore addressing the issues can bring about opportunities to bring about changes in our profession and for future professions, and clearly with the outcome of doing the best that we can for our students. So thank you.
Yeah, so, you know, on behalf of New York State AFERD, I'd like to thank both Dr. Richards and Dr. Ramsey for joining us today to share their thoughts and perspectives. You know, Dr. Richards, you joining us for New York State AFERD's podcast is quite a coup on our part. We're really excited. I've learned a lot from you. I consider you a friend. And if anything you've taught me is over the last couple years is to think about, you know, the profession from a socialization context and lens. And I appreciate that immensely. And it's an honor to have you. And I hope you'll join us again in the future.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun, guys. It's always a great opportunity to get on and chat with both of you. I consider both of you friends as well. Anytime you'd like to have me, I'd be happy to be back.
Thank you so much. So this session will be posted on the New York State AFERD website as the 8th episode on our podcast channel. Stay tuned for new and exciting episodes scheduled to be released later in the summer. Please visit us at newyorkstateaferd.org, social media handles at New York State AFERD, or call us at 315-823-1015 for more information. And please mark your calendars for our return to Turning Stone on November 18th, 2021.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Yeah.